Legend has it that if you say Candyman in front of a mirror 5 times, you'll summon the spirit of a terrifying killer with a hook for a hand, who's constantly surrounded by a swarm of bees. At least, that's the basic premise of the 1992 horror movie Candyman, about a white Chicago grad student who becomes obsessed with an urban myth haunting black residents of the notorious Cabrini Green housing projects. Now there's a sequel that brings back the villain for a modern audience, and it stars Yahya Abdul-Mateen II and Tiona Paris as a couple living in a now-gentrified Cabrini Green. The update is directed by promising up-and-coming filmmaker Nia DaCosta, who co-wrote the screenplay along with Jordan Peele and Wynne Rosenfeld. I'm Aisha Harris, and today we're talking about Candyman on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me today is NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe. Welcome back, Aisha.
Hey, glad to be here.
Yes, I love that you've become our resident horror.
I am too. That's like super exciting for me. I love the being a horror correspondent. This is like a dream come true.
Yes. And from his home in Denver, Colorado, is writer and film critic Walter Chow. Welcome back, Walter.
I'm so excited to be here with you. Thank you so much for having me.
And joining us again is Morning Edition producer Mark Rivers. Great to have you back as well, Mark.
Hey, Aisha. Thanks for having me.
So, in the new Candyman, it's 2019, and like pretty much every major American metropolis, Chicago's Cabrini Green neighborhood has been gentrified by upwardly mobile millennials. Emerging artist Anthony McCoy, played by Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, and his girlfriend and gallery director Brianna Cartwright, played by Tiona Paris, are a part of that gentrification, having just moved into a luxury building near where the housing projects once stood. Anthony learns of the urban legend of Candyman, a serial killer with a hook for a hand, from William Burke, an old resident of those housing projects played by Coleman Domingo. He's inspired to incorporate the myth into a new art project interrogating white flight and racism. And Candyman is summoned again, this time murdering the people in Anthony's life. So the creators make a lot of callbacks to the original 1992 film of the same name, which starred Virginia Madsen as Helen Lyle and Tony Todd in the title role. But if you've never seen the first movie, or it's been a while, this new version does a pretty good job laying out all the connections to what happened then while adding some new details to the folklore. Also, just a warning for everyone, there may be some minor spoilers in our conversation, so proceed with caution. So, I think we've all seen the original Candyman. If not, there were 2 other sequels that came after it before this one, all of them released in the 90s.
Less said about those, the better.
Yeah, so we're not really going to talk about those, but I'm excited to hear your thoughts. Aisha, let's start with you.
Yeah, so I have to say that I was so excited about this movie. It's been a long time since I saw the original Candyman. I didn't have much memory of it, but I was so excited when I saw this because I am very afraid of mirrors. And I will, you know, set this up by saying I have a full-length mirror in my room that I turn around every night to make sure that I don't see it as I'm sleeping, because I don't look at mirrors in the dark. And before I even watched this movie, I made sure the mirror was turned around. But I really liked this one. Like, I feel like it really stuck with me. I mean, to the point where after I'd watched the movie, it was time to go to bed. I was like, do I want to cut these lights off? Like, and that's my gauge of whether a horror movie really stuck with me, is when I'm like, I think I'm going to leave the lights on. I don't want to turn them off right now. I felt like it did so much, and I'm sure we'll get into it, for this moment, dealing with the depictions of violence against Black people, what that is, whether it's just entertainment, the line for that, the repercussions of that. And so I felt like it was so of this moment. It had a message, I felt like, but it wasn't like over the top beating you with the message. But it was also very much told from a Black perspective, which I appreciated, because you did not see Black people for the most part in this movie going Candyman, summoning him, which I felt like was real.
Yes.
Because when Tiona Paris, somebody said to her, you want to summon Candyman, her response and my response at the same time was, and since it's a family show, I'll say, heck no. That, but I said, I was like, are you saying, no, we ain't summoning nothing. Mm-mm. And so I felt like it was very real. So I really like this.
Yeah, there's even a moment where one character comments on how, like, Black people don't do that.
We don't be summoning people.
We don't conjure these things. Well, I'm so glad that it scared you, because, like you said, that is a good hint at whether or not a horror movie is doing its job.
Yes.
Mark, did this horror movie do its job for you?
You know, I think so. I mean, I don't get scared too easily by these kinds of movies.
Oh, he tough. He don't get scared.
But this is definitely, I think, a step up from her first movie, Little Woods, which Nia DaCosta's first movie. It was kind of this small indie that kind of tackled women's health care and the opioid crisis and this like beaten down North Dakota town. And you kind of felt that like it didn't have the perspective of someone who actually knew this world. Mm. And I think this movie works so much better because she's clearly intimately involved with what it's about, which is like the artist's responsibility to like Black trauma or Black pain. And I think it gives her storytelling greater punch. The movie's 90 minutes, thank God for that, you know?
A tight 90, which I just like.
Yes,
yes.
It doesn't want to like leave you guessing as to what it's about. It kind of like tells you like pretty early through the characters. It's like, hey, did you know that you live in a gentrified neighborhood? Why, yes, character. You know, I did know that. So it doesn't want you to guess as to what its intentions are, but I think its intentions are pretty potent, mm-hmm. as I used to say, for the time as well. I think it's very timely. In a time of them or antebellum Underground Railroad, it's like, what do we do with Black trauma? And also, in a more upsetting way, if the trauma could talk, like, what would it say?
Mm. Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up, you know, them, something like Lovecraft Country, because to me, those horrors did not work, in part because...
Candyman would be going after those creators. Candyman would be going right after them.
Oh, yeah. I like Lovecraft.
Right.
But them I couldn't get with. So
yeah.
I think it's a line, and I think that's what I was glad that this explored, that there is a line... Where does Black trauma become you're exploring a subject, and where does it become entertainment?
Yeah.
And you're using this for consumption. And I think that line is different for different people, but there is a line, and I think it gets crossed.
Yes, yes. Walter, what are your thoughts on Candyman? I know you really like the original movie.
Yeah, I love this series. I really do. I think it's one of the great movie bogeys because he's such a tragic figure. You know, he has a real tragic story. He has a real purpose. And, you know, for me, it's like it starts with a Clive Barker short story, which is good, but it's set in London. Candyman in the story is described as waxy, yellow, and pale. You know, he's sort of like a demonic clown figure in that one. There's no saying things in the mirror and stuff. And, you know, I'm not afraid of mirrors, but mirrors are afraid of me, I guess I would say. But and then Bernard Rose, the British director, takes that story, the seed of that story, and turns it into this story about Cabrini-Green in Chicago. He moves it to the United States. Ultimately, the story of Candyman, the original movie, is so rich with all of the themes, but it's rich with those without actually having to come out and lecture about them. And I use the term lecture carefully because I don't want to sound like one of those old Archie Bunker types. You know, I really love horror movies because they are so rich in that kind of subtext. I mean, Night of the Living Dead, I think, is the most important civil rights movie ever made. Mm. So Candyman does something like that. It is as important, I think, a film in many ways as Night of the Living Dead. What the DaCosta film for me was like in the first 10 minutes of the movie, and I timed it, there are two speeches about gentrification, about white supremacy. It's laid out there. It's almost like a Cliff's Notes for the themes of Candyman.
It was a project, it's affordable housing that had a particularly bad reputation.
You would never know.
Yeah, because they tore it down and gentrified the out of it.
Translation, white people built the ghetto and then erased it when they realized they built the ghetto.
And it's like, okay, this is an urgent theme, but now it's sort of like, here it is. We're going to lay it out for you real carefully. And I got an issue with that because now it becomes something like a TED Talk rather than a horror film. And I also have an issue with the messing around with the mythos. And I don't want to get into too many spoilers, but I will say that you cannot have an intellectually disabled man as a serial killer in your movie. Mm-hmm. You just can't. Mm-hmm. In this day and age, we're talking about this day and age, should have had a second thought about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I found it to be all the things that the white art critic that they hate so much in this movie.
they hated her.
Oh, man. She's wearing silk pajamas and listening to Fiona Apple. Only thing missing from this picture is boxed wine. You got everything except for the boxed wine. They hate her so much. And she says about the art show that she says it's didactic, knee-jerk cliche about the ambient violence of the gentrification cycle. And I guess I would say the same thing about the film. It's a didactic, knee-jerk cliche about the ambient violence of the gentrification cycle. Mm. It's like all of these topics deserve a more serious reckoning than this. Mm. You know, I didn't find it to be scary either. I didn't find it to be, you know, all those things. There is one kill in it that I think is brilliant and reminded me of a Dario Argento kill. It is so awesome. I think she shot it with a drone. But all the subtext has been brought into the light. Mm-hmm. And once you empty the basement of subtext, you have an empty basement. You got nothing underneath in the film. It's telling you exactly what it means. I wish the whole thing was shadow puppets. You know the shadow puppets that they used?
The shadow puppets. Yeah. The shadow puppets are the best part of the movie.
I love
the shadow puppets. I like the shadow puppets.
Yeah.
So I fall, I think, somewhere in between Walter and you, Aisha, and Mark, in that I feel like it did some really good things in terms of updating the story. But I agree with you, Walter. There's a lot of exposition in this movie. Mm-hmm. And some of it is warranted because that's what you always get in these movies. And it's a movie about myth-making and telling stories. And so, of course, there's going to be some exposition. It walks a very fine line between satirizing art and the idea of art about Black trauma being too violent and the way in which white people connect with it, sometimes giving into those proclivities unintentionally, I think. But for me, the things that worked were that kill that you're talking about, Walter. I loved that shot. I think as a director, she is just doing some really interesting things that I love. I think visually, I was struck by it. And I loved those moments where, you know, there's another scene where we see a kill through a mirror, but it's not the normal mirror that we see. And I thought that was really cool as well. There is gore. And I think there's some callbacks to the Cronenberg Fly, which mm-hmm. I really appreciated. I liked the way in which, you know, the Anthony character, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, he's like slowly being consumed by his art in a way. And it's taking over his body in the same way that Jeff Goldblum in The Fly is like becoming this grotesque figure. And I really appreciated those like very specific body horror moments. But yeah, I think that it's a tough thing to do. And this movie was supposed to come out last year. And I can't say that so much has changed, but a lot has changed even in the year that it was supposed to come out in terms of how we're thinking about it. Again, we have things like Lovecraft Country and Them and the Underground Railroad who are all reckoning with these things to various degrees of success. And I have to say that once we get to the end of this movie, to be honest, I was actually kind of confused. As much exposition as there is, I wasn't exactly sure what we were supposed to take away from the very end of it. There's another monologue that happens, and I had similar feelings about Jordan Peele's Us and the way they lay out stuff at the end of that movie, mm-hmm. where I was just like, wait, what?
Don't make this Us. Don't make this
Us. As confusing as Us was, and sometimes like a little too up its own, you know.
It didn't make no sense. It made no sense.
I still appreciated Us for like trying to go there, but I did feel like it was kind of suffering. The end of this movie was kind of suffering from the same issues at the end of that movie was, because I was paying attention, but I was also like, wait, how are we supposed to feel about this? What is this like final scene supposed to mean?
I think, you know, this is about storytelling. It's a series about storytelling and mythologies and the things that we tell each other as a culture to retain cohesion among our culture. The original Candyman does such a brilliant job because it is, you know, Helen, the star of that, is a grad student studying graffiti and studying urban legends and the Cabrini-Green thing. And the idea of Candyman was that he didn't want to be forgotten. He wanted the stories about him to be told and the fear of him to remain fresh among the citizens. And it's that fear that sort of binds them. The fear that in a community like Cabrini-Green, you could get murdered in your apartment and the police don't even care.
Right.
And there's arbitrariness about their existence. And there's like an idea that their lives don't matter. They got each other. That's it. Candyman in this movie seems to me to be like some kind of avenging angel. A thing that, you know, because of Black rage and the violence against Black people, comes back and gives the same back and more to the people who've been tormenting Black people.
The avenging angel thing, I think, is true. It's the idea that, okay, I don't want to see Black trauma. Do you want to see white trauma? Do you want to see white people attack? That it's right. A tough thing. It's a tough needle to thread. But it's also like this feeling of we've been under attack. And some of the feelings that I've had with some of these other movies, it's like, I don't want to see Black people getting beat up over and over again. They got to deal with racism. They got to deal with the police. And now they got to deal with some monster killing them too. Like, my goodness, can we get a break? And in this case, it's like, look, there's a monster, but it's not attacking this community, right?
Right,
like, there's a monster out there. And the white supremacy is out there, but it's not attacking the people who are already under attack.
Right.
Right. And so I'm not saying that's right, but I think that's why it's kind of the moment.
No, I think it's totally right. And I think you're sort of touching on this with the idea that it was supposed to have been released last year and things have changed, is that already the train is sort of leaving the station on the relevance of this. And it's always going to be relevant, white supremacy, all that and everything. But the Candyman as a character is like, you know, I'm not sure that this avenging angel aspect of Candyman works. And, you know, in the original film, I think he kills one white person and one black person. And it's like, why are black people being killed by Candyman? And again, I think it reflects this really harsh reality that whenever we look at victims of, you know, white supremacy, it's going to be a black body, yeah, unfortunately. And it's reflecting that rather than addressing that.
I mean, I think what was so potent about the original Candyman is that, like, it came out at a time where there was a lot of these movies that was kind of engaging in like an urban panic. Mm-hmm. And in the original Candyman, it is about that urban panic and also interrogating that. Like the way a housing project like Cabrini Green becomes more than a housing project through the fears of those who are like, don't even want to drive through. And I love the idea that the Candyman was created by those who killed him. It's like racism like created him. And like,
right,
it kind of fades into this idea of like, you know, this monstrous black man that only really exists in the white man's imagination. And while this movie does make the subtext of the first one text, I think the text is kind of so strong that it can just kind of work as just kind of a crowd pleaser kind of movie.
Yeah. And I think it's worth just one final point, which is that in case you haven't seen the movie in a while, the folklore in the first Candyman movie is that he was the victim of a lynching,
right,
for miscegenation. And I think that's part of, for me at least, why this new Candyman, even though it does fall into these trappings, so many of these reimaginings are often taking text that did not initially have that sort of social component already baked into it. I give it a little bit more leeway for still engaging with that, if on a different complete level.
I love that you mentioned that, because black men are saddled with the stereotype in this culture of being sexually predacious.
And right? Predatory, yeah.
And predatory. In this film, there's a scene where he goes to the library to do some research. Who does that?
in 2019? I don't know.
He's old school.
Yeah. He's old school like that. He goes to the library, and this white librarian gets super flustered, gets super interested, wants to flirt with him.
Yaya. I mean, he's nice. As a film critic, he is a nice-looking man. I'm saying that as a critic.
Can I tell you, I would act exactly the same way if I met Yaya. Handsome man.
He is.
I don't blame her one bit. In a movie, though, about a person who has been saddled with this stereotype, I think it's dangerous, again, to not be in control of these moments that you think are funny. We have to be careful with some of those images, right, when it plays into the stuff. And the really awesome murder scene that we're talking about after it, Yaya has just left this really, really nice apartment. I'm sure there's security cameras everywhere. People know he's been there. In this world, right, in the world outside of Candyman 2021, he is prime suspect number one. And
yeah,
maybe,
yeah,
probably is not making it to the station.
Yeah.
For me, I'm like, I'm missing that part of the social consciousness. And I'm getting instead sort of the ventriloquism of social consciousness filtered through, you know, all these speeches. Really, 15-minute mark. There's three separate people that says, well, gentrification is actually dot, dot, dot. I cannot believe that you're doing this right now.
It's doing more telling than showing,
yeah,
for it sure.
Is. Yeah. 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 Well, we want to know what you think about Candyman. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. And when we come back, it'll be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision, kind of like choosing to listen to your favorite song on repeat. And with their top-rated app, you can deposit checks and transfer money anytime, anywhere, making Capital One an even easier decision. That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Blue Moon, a refreshingly bright Belgian-style wheat ale brewed with Valencia orange and coriander for a flavor and appearance like nothing else. And now, try the new Blue Moon Light Sky, brewed with tangerine peel. Just 95 calories and 3.6 grams of carbs per 12-ounce can. Have them delivered today at get.bluemoonbeer.com/happyhour. Blue Moon. Made brighter. Celebrate responsibly. Blue Moon Brewing Co., Golden, Colorado, Ale.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What's Making Us Happy? Aisha, let's start with you.
So I'm going back into the, you know, kind of crates on this one. And sometimes when life gets really hard and it's been a rough few weeks, I like to watch things that are really like cartoons. Like sometimes even reality TV is too serious for me. I need something really light. And so I have been watching Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated. This is on, it's on Netflix. It's on Boomerang if you have that. But it is a version of Scooby-Doo with a connective storyline. Mm. So it's set with the gang in Crystal Cove. There are mysteries for each show, obviously, and people in masks and stuff. But there's also this larger mystery. There was a group of kids years before who disappeared. There was another Scooby gang that disappeared, and we don't know why they disappeared. And that is the world in which this is set. I will give a warning. There are some very trite, like, teenage love stories. They try to make Velma in love with Shaggy. It's really, and they kind of make the women, in a very misogynistic way, kind of make them nags a bit. Mm. That is very dated. It's not good. But get past that. It's a nice little show. Watch Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that, Aisha. Mark, what is making you happy this week?
So I tried to start Mike White's White Lotus. Mm. At this point, I don't know how much I can take these characters. I'm still going to finish it, but right now I'm kind of like, eh. But it made me want to go back to his previous show, Enlightened, which was this HBO show. It only lasted two seasons. It stars Laura Dern, this great sense of performance. This woman, she's this like sales executive, and she has this bit of a nervous breakdown at work. And then she comes out of this rehab stint trying to be a better person because she becomes this kind of moral crusader in a way, but she's also kind of insufferable as a person. Like, you don't want to be around her, even though she's kind of right about a lot of things. The show is like really unconventional. It's more, it just finds great drama in just the mundane and just the way that life around you just seems to be out to embarrass you. This show really understands that in a way that I think anybody can relate to. So if you're into White Lotus, I would say go back to Enlightened. Great show. Only two seasons. You'll get through it quick.
Perfect. I love it even more. Walter, what is making you happy?
Well, first I got to say, my mind is blown by the Scooby-Doo description that you just gave. I grew up on Scooby-Doo. To think that there's more than one gang, that is freaking me out a little bit.
Scooby-Doo expanded universe.
Yeah, you're just making me more excited to watch it. You know, this whole last week, last 2 weeks, I've been covering this festival out of Montreal called Fantasia Fest, and they show so many, dozens and dozens of films, science fiction, horror generally, but all sorts of other stuff too. And the movies I've seen there are so good. I mean, the opening night film was Suicide Squad, the James Gunn, which I liked a lot. But there's an exorcism movie called Agnes by an Oklahoma filmmaker named Mickey Reese that is brilliant. There's a Japanese time travel movie called Beyond the Infinite 2 Minutes by Junta Yamaguchi, Hellbender by this family of filmmakers. You know, it's this mother and daughter witches. They play in a punk band and they live by themselves in the woods. And it's just, man, there's some really, really exciting stuff going on in genre filmmaking right now. And I got to see so much of it. That's what I was excited about.
Yes. Thank you, Walter. That's a lot of movies we have to look for in the coming year or so. So I actually just want to play my happy this week. Girl, you look good. Want your vax that thing up. You're a handsome young brother. Want your vax that thing up. Dating in real life, you need to vax that thing up. Feeling freaky all night, you need to vax that thing up. So, in honor of the FDA finally approving the Pfizer vaccine this week, and hopefully, I hope that people decide to get vaxxed.
If you can't listen to Dr. Fauci, like, please listen to Juvenile. Like, come on.
I want to see Dr. Fauci backing that thing up, to vax that thing up. That's what I want to see.
Yeah. So this song and video came out actually in July. So earlier this summer, it was a collaboration between Juvenile, Manny Fresh, Mia X, and BLK. It's a dating app for singles. And they put out this video and updated the Back That Thing Up song to be about vaxing that thing up. Yeah. And I love how it's like part safe sex and also part like safe COVID or safe pandemic.
Well, you gotta be safe because, you know, you exchange those COVID vibes when you're out there dating. Yeah.
So it's just making me so happy that it exists. I love that, you know, especially earlier this week, Busta Rhymes came out as a, I don't know what we want to call them, a pandemic.
Anti-masker, whatever.
Anti-vaxxer.
Anti-masker, you know, the worst possible thing we want anyone to be right now. So seeing Juvenile and Manny Fresh and Mia X doing their thing and vaxxing that thing, I'm all for it.
So, yes. I'm with you on that.
That is what is making me happy this week. And if you want links for what we recommended, plus some more recommendations, subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. I'm at Crafting My Style. You can find the other Aisha at Aisha Roscoe, Mark at Mark A. Rivers, and Walter at Mangiato. You can follow editor Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, producer Candace Lim at TheCandaceLim, and producer Jared Gare at Jared M. Gare. And you can follow producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you are almost certainly bobbing your head to right now. And thank you all for being here.
Thanks, I had fun.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So great to be here.
And thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. We'll see you all next week when we will be talking about happy endings.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.